Good afternoon. Welcome to the LaRouche Show. This is Michelle Steinberg from Executive Intelligence Review. I'm your host today, December 7th, 2002. And we will be highlighting the economy of the United States, what's left of it, and how to rebuild it. With us today from Leesburg, Virginia, will be Richard Freeman and Anita Gallagher, both from Executive Intelligence Review. Richard and Anita have been following the economic collapse from the standpoint of a record budget deficit for the federal government and the states, and the collapse of major infrastructure, airlines. This was big news this week. But they've also been working to focus attention on the solution, Mr. Lyndon LaRouche's Super TVA. An update, a revival, an expansion of the Tennessee Valley Authority, one of the most important infrastructure projects ever undertaken by the United States of America. I guess I don't have to tell the audience this week there was a meltdown of policy in Washington, especially economic policy, when Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill was dumped. Unceremoniously dumped, and Chief Presidential Economic Advisor Larry Lindsey was also dumped. Don't believe the reports about resignations, retirement, something like this. This was a major shakeup, and Lyndon LaRouche warned you about it. Then there is the saga of United Airlines, which was once one of the nation's premier airlines. It is teetering on the edge of collapse. For the LaRouche movement, these developments were not a surprise. You may recall that Mr. LaRouche was interviewed here on the October 19th edition of The LaRouche Show, where he said that after the November 5th election, the crisis would turn to the economy. On October 19th, all eyes and ears and attention was riveted on the Iraq War, which is not inevitable, but as Mr. LaRouche has warned time and again, it's not inevitable, but it's still possible. The real answer to stopping the Iraq War is to get a shift in economic policy. The plunge protection team and the other tricks to keep the economic indicators up through the month of October would not last. They did not last. And LaRouche said the economy would become the dominant crisis. That's about where we are today. And I'd like to get right to the point and welcome Richard to begin the discussion with a briefing on the crisis. Welcome, Rich.
Thanks for having me, Michelle. I think, as Michelle said, this the resignations really highlight the point. This means that the two of the major policymakers for economics in the Bush administration are gone. At this point, we'll soon hear announcements of who might replace them. But at this point, what it signals is a bankruptcy of the Bush administration economic policy. And it now throws it open. If Bush were to choose someone, one person whose name has come up a few times, outgoing Senator Phil Gramm from Texas, who's known for his budget-cutting proclivities, such as the Gramm-Rudman Act of 1985, that would just simply say that they were going to follow an insane policy. That would be very dangerous. We don't know that he's going to. There's reports that George W. may not like Phil Gramm personally. But the real question is not even who's going to be the replacement, although they'll be focusing on that and we'll soon know. The real question is, will this administration now listen to Lyndon LaRouche in the same way that LaRouche was able to jam up the push for war? By bringing it to the United Nations, as he said it must be, by, as he said, acting on the institution of the presidency, which, as he said, is not just the president, but as the people in the executive branch, former presidents, are present and retired military and so forth. And we will need channels, including people who are listening right now, to act on this, to change the policy so that Bush follows the only sane policy he can, which would be LaRouche's Super TVA, which we'll be discussing. I just want to give just a brief outlook at the federal budget to give you a sense of where we find ourselves in terms of the budget picture. Last year, which was fiscal year 2002, which ended on September 30th of this year, the United States fiscal budgets run from October 1st of one year through September 30th of the next year. So our fiscal 2003 budget started on October 1st of this year. But the budget that ended September 30th of 2002, which was the fiscal year 2002 budget, had a $317.3 billion deficit. That's the general revenue budget. There's also a second figure that some of our listeners may have heard, which is called the unified budget, which is a sham budget. And that ran a budget deficit of $157 billion. In either case, both of those numbers are extremely large. Why did we run a $317 billion budget deficit? And that's what we should look at. And the critical thing is that this fiscal year, on a general revenue budget basis, we are looking at a $400 to $500 billion deficit, which would be the largest in history. And I think one way of situating this is that the deficit is so large that the Congress convened in November with 11 out of the 13 major appropriation bills not decided on. The only two that were decided on were the defense budget and the defense construction budget. And so they're going to come back January 11th. They're going to have to sit down and talk about what they're going to do. And they don't know what to do. They may slash and cut and cut. And we'll see why that would be a disastrous decision. But they simply said, we'll pray during December that something drops from heaven and it'll solve itself on January 11th. It won't. And the new economic advisors have no solutions, I would say, other than, you know, that they could do within the bag of tricks that they know. Now, the reason for the collapse of the budget, and there's several features one could say, was a tremendous drop in revenues. And in the general revenue budget, about 60% of the revenues come from taxes, more than 60%. About 60% come from various taxes on individuals. The individual income tax is the biggest element. And in that, in fiscal year 2001, and people see the dimensions of this, the individual income taxes were $994 billion. In fiscal year 2002, they were $858 billion. That is a drop from fiscal year 2001 to fiscal year 2002, the one that just completed, of $136 billion. That is the largest drop in the history of the United States in absolute amount. The percent of drop in individual income tax was 13.7%. That is the largest drop in 70 years. So this is what happened in 2002 revenue budget. I should say the amount drop was the largest in 70 years, and the percent drop is the largest in 70 years, not the largest in history. So how did the revenues of individual income taxes drop $136 billion? Well, one of the key things, there's two ways to look at this, and this I think will get at it. Where does individual income come from? It comes from a normal side of the real economy, wages and salaries. It also comes from capital gains. The capital gains are when you buy a stock or a house at one price, hold it for a while, and sell it for a higher price after a while. And that increase is the capital gain. And the stock market was sending capital gains through the ceiling. So that what happened was capital gains in 2001 reached $644 billion. And the taxes on that was over $120 billion. As the stock market bubble collapsed beginning March 2000, the new economy collapsed, the NASDAQ collapsed, just as Lyndon LaRouche said they would. Then capital gains started disappearing. People weren't getting profits from their sales. They were getting losses. Capital gains, as an estimate, fell from $644 to $322 billion. They fell in half. And by last year, the taxes from capital gains were down to $66 billion. They had fallen by more than $55 billion. So suddenly the government, our government, had become addicted to getting taxes from the speculative stock market bubble and from the speculative run-up in houses. That got wiped out. The other side of individual income taxes is the real part of it, which is people go to work and get wages and salaries. Well, over the last 2 years, somewhere between 2.5 and 3.5 million people have been laid off. As Anita will say, people have been getting wage cuts in the airlines for the last 2 years already. In the high-tech sector, those who kept their jobs had wage cuts. When you lose your job or you get a wage cut, you pay less taxes. So that is those two are the major reasons why there was a $136 billion drop in individual taxes, and that pulled the bottom out of the budget. There was some increase in spending. One of the things that was increased in spending was more unemployment insurance payments and more food stamps. So that was what happened last year. Then just to conclude, this year, in the first month of the fiscal year, which is October, The general revenue budget ran a $58 billion deficit for 1 month. That's more than most countries run in a deficit if they have a deficit for the entire year. And the United States managed to do that in the first month of the fiscal year 2003, which was October. On that basis, and if the revenues keep dropping the way they are, we will have a $400 to $500 billion deficit. And this is something that this doesn't count a war in Iraq if one were to occur. We hope it doesn't. We'll try to prevent it. This doesn't include very big expansion of Homeland Security. And so this thing is just simply exploding out from under the Bush administration at this point.
Well, I know why they have a bit of a headache in Washington. They're trying to cover all this stuff up and pull the wool over the eyes of the population, and it's obviously not working. Anita, I'm going to ask you to sum up another aspect of this collapse, and two questions. You can answer them in whichever order you want. The United Airlines collapse. What exactly got turned down, and why were the other airlines rooting for the bankruptcy court, if you will? Secondly, I heard that you and some other colleagues ran into some legislators and other public officials dealing with the budget crisis in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And that must have been an interesting exchange. So why don't you tell us about either one of those things, because they're both quite relevant.
Well, thanks, Michelle. It's good to be here. The United Airlines really was a meltdown. The CEO, Glenn Tilton, gave a message to United employees in which he led them to believe that there will be a bankruptcy filing before the weekend is over. This would be the fifth biggest bankruptcy in U.S. history, and certainly the biggest in the airline industry. This has been a big, messy, very public affair, and it was forced because the Air Transportation Stabilization Board, which listeners may remember was established after September 11th, was a facility designed to give airlines loan guarantees. It had $10 billion in loan guarantee capability, which would have meant that an airline could get a loan from the bank and be assured of repayment by the U.S. government. Several small airlines applied on June 10th. U.S. Airways, which was the seventh largest, applied, and the window for applications to the ATSB closed on June 30th. United applied, has been revising its application since it was made, has been increasing the cuts, has been increasing the givebacks demanded, had a scenario where all of the unions and all of the vendors had to agree to givebacks in the 7% range. This would have produced a $5.2 billion savings in wages over 5.5 years, which was very, very difficult for United employees to swallow. Because listeners may remember in 1994, United Airlines was in trouble and persuaded the mechanics and the pilots to accept stock in the company in lieu of a wage increase.
Wow.
So the mechanics have been working since 1994, in effect, without a wage increase. And I think listeners know what has happened to prices and the cost of living in the meantime. They got stock in the company. In the late 1990s, it was worth $1 a share. It stopped trading on Thursday when it was worth $1.
It was $100 a share.
I'm sorry, it was $100 a share. And now it's down to $1.
So it lost 99% of its value.
And this is worthless. This was the currency instead of wage increases. The pension funds are full of this stock, now worthless. And so a bankruptcy was really dreaded in particular because of this aspect of things. But the Air Transportation Stabilization Board came right out and said that they were rejecting United's plan because their revenue projections were too optimistic. And I guess this will be the theme song of Richard and me today, because revenue falls during a depression. And there is no way that any cuts can keep pace with the rate at which revenue falls. And so you have spectacles like in this sort of parallel spectacle of U.S. Airways, the seventh largest airline, asking for the loan guarantee, asking for the givebacks, then filing bankruptcy, then being approached by various predators who want to buy up assets for pennies on the dollar during bankruptcy, then making a deal, if you can imagine, 37% of U.S. Airways going for $240 million to the retirement systems of Alabama, only to have their chief executive come back late in the week and say, sorry, we're retrading the deal because you are continuing to lose revenue faster than you're making cuts. So the only way out of this is LaRouche's super TVA, to re-regulate the airlines, to put the whole financial system into a debt freeze, into bankruptcy, and to save the jobs, save the air transportation capability, and other essential services. It's simply this United case for people in industry as well as people in state governments is just, you know, writing the point large that there is not going to be any revenue, there is not going to be any uptick, there's not going to be any turnaround, and cuts are not going to do it. And to your second question, Michelle, we did have an interesting time yesterday at the Council of State Governments. And listeners may want to know that many state legislators are quite aware that their state has no money. And there are very few people who will argue today, as many were even arguing a few months ago, that we are not in a depression. But there is a certain, there's a great deal of interest in what Lyndon LaRouche has to say, a great deal of resonance with the idea of going back to policies that Roosevelt used, which worked before, but at the same time, a great deal of passivity almost at seeing themselves doing this, because it really means to say that the system doesn't work anymore, that we turned on the spigot and there are rocks coming out instead of water. And that's where it's the battle lies at this point. And I think that people are quite aware that there's no other solution on the table. There are various state legislators who have projects. There are schemes in various places in Virginia. Some people want to increase the car tax again. It's like at the federal level, the people who want to repeal George Bush's tax cut to get that money. But it's a pittance, and they are going to find, like United and US Air found, that revenue is going to decline even faster. And any solution arrived at in terms of the existing system on paper is simply going to evaporate within days.
Thank you. What you described with the Air Transportation Stability Board rejecting these terms, you didn't cut enough, is what we've been talking about for years as to what the IMF has done to Argentina, Brazil, Turkey, you name it. And so you have an IMF type of dictatorship going on in the United States, and this is gouging, looting people's income. Now, I think one of the best things that we can do for the remainder of the hour and fit in some more of the briefing, like this incredible unemployment statistic that came, or series of statistics that came out yesterday, is to invite questions from our listeners on how to implement LaRouche's TVA. We already have an email from a listener in Northern Virginia that says, now that there's implicit recognition of the grave nature of the economic crisis, evidenced by the firing of O'Neill and Lindsay, what do you think are the chances that the Bush administration will take the kind of measures advocated by LaRouche? That is, FDR-style emergency recovery programs to finally turn this mess around. So I'd like to welcome the people we can't see right now, the organizers' conference line being hosted today by Bob Baker. Actually, there's a lot of activities going on in the LaRouche movement. Just about now, I believe, a Lyndon LaRouche campaign event, LaRouche in 2004, emergency town meeting on infrastructure, is happening or about to happen at the Carson, California Hilton Hotel, featuring an address by Lyndon LaRouche, which I understand will be on his website by this evening. But going to our organizers conference line. Bob Baker is going to take questions and communicate them to our listening audience. So I hope that our technicians tell me when Bob is ready to give a question to Rich and Anita. So while we're waiting for that, Richard, from what Anita said, how many of those United Airlines employees are going to bolster next week's unemployment figures, and what's that looking like?
Good. And I also, when we get a chance, maybe during the show, want to just say a word or two on the state budgets, how they look as a sort of national picture. But yeah, I mean, it was announced yesterday officially that the unemployment had rate had increased from 5.7 to 6%, and that the number of unemployed went from 8.2 million roughly to 8.5 million. The actual increase, therefore, is 300,000. It was actually 299,000, close enough. Now, this is gigantic. And what is interesting in this case is that this government puts out two sets of figures. One is the Employment Establishment Survey, or Payroll Survey. And that's, they take the survey of the places where people work. That, they said, dropped 40,000 jobs, which is true. And it's bad, and it's significant. And that's what all the news media would give you the impression, that we only lost 40,000 jobs. But there's a household survey, which is a broader survey. Just to give you an example, if two people have a job, they will each be counted in the household survey. But if they're both working this same job, one's working 20 hours of a job at a place and another person's working 20 hours, it will show up in some cases in the establishment survey as only one job, whereas we know two people are working. So if you take the broader household survey, two things happened. 689,000 people were reduced from employment. Now, I just said 299,000 of them ended up officially unemployed. Well, 689,000 is bigger than 299,000. So what happened to the roughly 380,000 other people? They left the labor force. And the trick is that if you leave the labor force, you are counted as not in the labor force. That makes sense. But if you're counted not in the labor force, you can't be unemployed, because you have to be in the labor force to be unemployed. So these people basically just disappeared from the unemployment statistics. So we really lost employment of 689,000 in 1 month. The funny thing to this, there's a funny side and not so funny side. The not so funny side is this was the 28th month in which we've lost manufacturing employment. We've now lost 45,000 manufacturing jobs, of which 36,000 were those who actually work on the assembly lines and so forth, really produce our existence. Over these 28 months, we have lost 1.99 million manufacturing jobs. We've lost 1.54 million production manufacturing jobs. That's almost 13% of our production manufacturing workforce has been wiped out in 28 months when we're told we're in a recovery. This is a decimation of our productive labor force. If you lose your productive manufacturing workers, you are losing the future of your ability to produce. So that is the very serious side. The funny side was the headlines were, Washington Post says, unemployment unexpectedly surged. And Bloomberg had a headline that said, only 5 out of 60 economists predicted that unemployment would go up. So you have to wonder what sort of planet these people are living on, because, of course, this thing is taking force, and it's because, as Anita referenced, it's a breakdown crisis, as LaRouche said. This is not a repeat of 1929-32. That was a cyclical process which was very, very deep. This is like a comet headed to the sun, in which your financial system is imploding and your physical system will break down on the level of what we saw during the Dark Ages, not what we saw in 1929-32, as bad as that was. And therefore, the solutions to that cannot be within the domain of anything people would normally think of. That's where LaRouche uniquely comes in. And I would just say this calls the question of why this has to be done, why LaRouche's policy has to be done. It's not because it is a good policy, which it is. It's because uniquely it is the only policy that can work in the breakdown crisis.
Okay, remember we still have a question on the table about what are the chances for LaRouche's TVA. And we have Bob Baker ready to give us one of the questions from the organizers conference line. Bob, are you with us?
Yes. So we had a question from Adam in Pennsylvania. He wanted to know, what is the state of Amtrak right now?
Okay.
Well, that's a great question. Amtrak requested last year, for the fiscal year starting October 1st, which is fiscal year 2003, $1.9 billion. It looks like they will get $720 million. You can tell that that's less than half of what they need. So they're in a very, very terrible shape.
Are they going to cut the front end of the train or the back end of the train?
They're going to cut two out of every four wheels. And on the basis of these cost accountants, that should make it work. Yes, I mean, they have no idea. They just closed some stations in Michigan last week, two stations they closed. And they're going to be closing them across the country. The further crisis on this is that the new head of the Senate Transportation Committee is reportedly John McCain, who, aside from being a nutcase on about 20 other issues, is also a nutcase on Amtrak, and has said that he wants to cut it down, that he doesn't see any reason for the United States government to be providing for Amtrak. Now, we only move 0.6% of our population between cities on rail. That is insane for an industrial nation. We should be moving 10, 15, 20%. I don't know the exact percentage. You could determine it by how things work. But to be doing less than 1% makes no sense. Therefore, what we need is for Amtrak to be funded at the full $1.9 billion. But to take it one step further, in Lyndon LaRouche's emergency infrastructure program, he has said, look, we need to preserve Amtrak. This is, we need to preserve our air grid. We can't exist without them. Anyone who says that we can tolerate these bankruptcies, they're only so much money, these people just don't know what they're talking about. But what we must do with Amtrak is we must move to high-speed rail. And there's plans of the Department of Transportation and others. We have published the plans in the EIR and in LaRouche's emergency program, which is circulating, people can get if they don't have it, for 12,000 to 15,000 miles of high-speed rail. That's rail that is steel on steel. It goes about 180 miles an hour in France and so on. But what we must move beyond that is to high-speed magnetically levitated trains, which will cruise at 300 to 350 miles an hour, five times present transportation. That means we will actually be able to link up to the whole world.
Okay, thank you. We're going to take a break now, tell people how to contact us. You're listening to The LaRouche Show. I'm your host, Michelle Steinberg, Counterintelligence Co-Director of Executive Intelligence Review. Today our guests are Anita Gallagher with EIR, an organizer for the LaRouche movement and a writer for EIR. She's been following the collapse of United Airlines, all of the airlines actually, and pushing to implement LaRouche's Super TVA. And our other guest is Richard Freeman of the economics section of EIR. The LaRouche Show airs every week at 3 p.m. to 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and you can reach the webcast at the website of EIR. That's www.larouchepub.com. During the live broadcast, you can ask questions by calling one of the following numbers. Toll-free from the U.S. is 1-866-857-4327. Again, that's 1-866-857-4327. Or you can email your questions to radio@larouchepub.com. If you enjoy listening to the LaRouche show and reading the publications, you can also see Lyndon LaRouche and his associates on cable TV every week in dozens of locations across the country. The LaRouche Connection appears on your local cable TV station. For more information about this, visit our internet homepage at www.larouchepub.com/TV. And across the country, from Wyoming to Alabama, there are multiple sites. Times are listed. You can hear the LaRouche conference presentations, culture, history, counterintelligence. It is all there. If you want information about how to get the LaRouche Connection on your cable station, you can call Charles Notley at 703 777 9451 extension 322. Okay, we're going to come back to the organizer's conference call, and Bob has several more questions. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, we've got some good questions. Bruce Green from Minnesota, he wants to know, what's happening to Social Security? How will this economic situation affect what's happening there?
Richard.
Well, it's not as secure as you would want. One of the ways I get this unified sham budget, I'll give you an example. I said that the general revenue budget was a deficit of $317 billion in fiscal year 2002. And I said the unified budget was $157 billion. Let me just say what they are. The general revenue budget is what we've always called the U.S. budget since the country was started in 1789. It's our expenditures, you know, our income taxes, corporate taxes, excise taxes. That's our revenues, and our expenditures are defense and infrastructure building and social programs. When Social Security was created in 1935 by Franklin Delano Roosevelt, he set it up as a special fund which had its own earmarked tax, which everyone pays, as you know, is your Social Security tax from your wages. And the purpose was to make sure that that money went for people's retirement through a federal Social Security payment. In 1980s, when the budget deficit got so out of hand, the Reagan administration said, well, look, we can't keep publishing these budget deficit figures. They look terrible. So we won't just use the general revenue budget. Why don't we come up with a new animal, and we'll call it the unified budget, and we'll take the general revenue budget, and we'll also take the Social Security fund, which legally cannot be mixed with the general revenue budget, but we'll do it anyway. It's off budget, but we'll mix them together, and we'll call it a unified budget. And by doing that, by taking the Social Security funds, we will reduce the apparent deficit. Now, do they actually spend the Social Security funds? Not directly, but by the way that the budget process works, actually, yes. So to the extent that they said in 2003 that the Treasury Department, the Office of Management and Budget, and everybody else said that we had only $157 billion deficit, what they were saying was that we're taking $160 billion surplus of the Social Security Fund, mixing it with the General Revenue Budget, which was $317 billion in deficit, and reducing the deficit down to $157 billion. That means that money will not be there for Social Security. So people should know, first of all, it's being looted already. But then there are plans to privatize Social Security. I would just say the third point on this is your greatest Social Security has to be the security of the economy. And, we should be concerned about the Social Security. But right now, with a free fall, we have to address the question of how do you rebuild? Because only by rebuilding the whole economy can we rebuild the revenue base of the United States. There's no other way to rebuild the revenue base. Higher taxes, lower taxes, that's not the issue. Budget cutting, when you cut a budget, as Anita was saying, you gouge real physical activity. That gouges the ability to produce a revenue. Your revenues drop, and you widen the deficit. So tax cutting is not the way to do it. Therefore, we have to have a way of revolutionary generating an upsurge of economic activity. And by doing that, the tax base rises naturally, which will restore our budgets on the federal level and state and local level to health. And that's what the LaRouche Super TVA will accomplish towards the budget process, and therefore make sure that people don't loot Social Security.
Okay, we talked a little bit about the state budget deficits on top of the federal deficit. Anita was telling us about the conference she was at in Richmond. I have two questions for you, Anita, again. Multiple questions, complex domain. On the United Airlines front, the Association of Machinists have put up a resistance to the cuts. Is this a revolutionary resistance, or where is that headed? Do they have a solution? And what is Mr. LaRouche saying to do about the airline situation?
Well, that's a very good question. And the International Association of Machinists has had a sort of unique position among all of the trade unions who are in the United Employee Group. They have been very militant. They have been the toughest to sell the givebacks to. But at the same time, the fact that they misunderstand the nature of the economic period that we are in and have not listened to LaRouche is killing them. Because what Tom Buffenbarger first said when the head of United Airlines said after September 11th, and of course LaRouche correctly made the point, and everyone sees now that the airline problems did not start with September 11th. But at that point, the chairman said, we are hemorrhaging money, and we are heading for bankruptcy. And the International Association of Machinists, Tom Buffenbarger, said, absolutely not. Open the books. This is an irresponsible statement. And their position has been that the management of United had frittered away money, trying for a merger with U.S. Airways, trying to set up a bizjet division, these sorts of things. So that the militancy was headed toward an area in which it couldn't work. They were demanding wage gains that were not there, because in fact United was bankrupt, because revenues and available cash for flying and the business revenues were collapsing as corporations were going bankrupt. So this particular, I think it's important to make the point about what a Wall Street bankruptcy is versus the kind of bankruptcy which Lyndon LaRouche is talking about. Because bankruptcy, as our listeners probably know, was something that was invented by Franklin Roosevelt, a Chapter 11 bankruptcy, to save companies from liquidation, to allow them to continue operating, to save what was productive for the general welfare of the citizenry. That's the kind of bankruptcy which LaRouche is talking about. The whole system is bankrupt. The monetary financial system has got to be put into bankruptcy. The economy, the productive aspect, such as our transportation grid, can be saved. This is not about looting. This is not about an exercise through which union contracts can be thrown out, through which the value of the employee-owned stock, because 55% of the stock of United is owned by its employees, can be rendered worthless. It's not about a predator type of process, which is what bankruptcy of previous airlines and other entities has been about on Wall Street today. So, you know, LaRouche has spoken very often about the failure of leadership in the political parties, and he made the point very forcefully that leadership is leadership for change, because the old system is gone. So leadership and who is a leader is defined by who is ready to look at reality and who's ready to bring about the reforms which would work. The new Bretton Woods monetary system, re-regulation, going back to the credit policies that most people associate with Roosevelt. So that's the direction that the trade union movement, as well as the leadership of the Democratic and Republican parties, have got to go on. And it has been lacking at the very top, because people have not faced what Richard says. This is a systemic crisis. It is the end of a system. There are no slick moves within the system that are going to work. There are no paper deals that can be made, because the paper is bankrupt.
Okay, let's go back to that first email question we had. Given the shakeup, the meltdown in Washington, what are the chances of LaRouche's TVA? Why don't you go first, Anita, and then Rich?
Well, I think LaRouche's TVA is the only chance. And what chance it has really depends on what all of our listeners and what we do. It depends on us. It's not something we can sit on the sidelines and handicap, but it is abundantly clear that it is the only chance. There is a wide open organizing situation, in the sense that people are in a sort of slightly depressed state of mind about the fact that everything that they have ever done in their careers to fix and plug budget holes no longer works. And we have to simply do mass education, such as we've done in the special report which Richard wrote so much on, the emergency infrastructure report that is available from Executive Intelligence Review. And we need to get these policies adopted by leadership of a political movement. We need to rebuild the Democratic Party around these things. We need to have these things discussed. Wherever there's discussion of a crisis, and the crisis, this has to be discussed, because it is the only solution. So I think that it really, that no one should kid themselves that there's any other way out of this, and that we have to go all out to get this way adopted.
Yeah, well, I I think there's two ways of looking at it, both what we're going to do in the United States and what's happening already internationally. As people know, Italy has already, in one of its chambers, passed a resolution saying we need a new Bretton Woods, which is the context of a new monetary system after putting the old system through Chapter 11 bankruptcy organization to get credit flows where they have to be. And there are other exciting developments like that, that show the context of why this is possible in this time. I just want to say one thing first, is if you look at the state budgets, this year, the fiscal year of the state budget starts on July 1st. They had $49.5 billion of deficit, 40 of the states, 40 out of the 50. But as Michelle and I were discussing before, that could reach 50 out of the 50 before this year is over. So you're just starting with a figure. 3 months into it, after all the cutting to get $49.5 billion in deficits down, and the National Governors Association have said this is the worst deficit crisis since the 1930s. And these guys, you know, issue statements, you know, they're the floor of their house could be on falling out. And they say, oh, we're just having to do a little redecorating. I mean, they make the most mild statements you can imagine. So they're saying worse since the 30s. But after they started with $49.5 billion in cut deficit and had to cut and take funds and so forth, 3 months later they said, well, we have another $18 to $20 billion in deficit. Let me give you one example. Take California. There you have Gray Davis, not the worst person in the world, but a typical Democrat in the sense that he's not willing to name the fact that we're in a depression and say that we have to revoke all the deregulation rules which we had since the 1930s that undid the regulation that Roosevelt had put forward. He's not willing to do that. So what does he do? He has a $24.1 billion deficit. He just announced yesterday $10.2 billion in cuts, which is going to massacre education, massacre health services. It's going to destroy the ability of elderly citizens to live, even if they got their Social Security checks. And this guy's going to do it in the name of trying to, quote, protect the people. Well, I'm sorry, this is the problem of the Democratic Party. You can't be a good budget cutter and say, I'm doing it in the Democratic way. There is no such way. You're destroying the population. Now, what would the Super TVA do? Look, the concept is this. After putting, and simultaneous with putting the whole international bankruptcy system, which is the whole system which has over $400 trillion in obligations, $300 trillion of which roughly are these high leverage bets called derivatives, you just wipe it out. You put it through Chapter 11, as Nita was saying, in which the purpose is not to destroy the productive capacity, but rather to say, okay, if you have 100, this is an example, a company, you have $2 billion of debts, we allow you to pay off only 10% of that, $200 million, write off the other $900 million, so you're not strangled by your debts. And then you can protect your workforce, you can protect your plant and equipment, you can start producing again. Well, if you can do that with a company under Chapter 11, you can do it for a whole economy. So you go through a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Then what you need is new credit at 1% to 2% interest rates generated, as LaRouche's Super TVA would do, on the scale he hasn't said yet, but I can imagine he's thinking several hundred billions of dollars, and Lynn will speak for himself on this question. And you generate it into infrastructure. Rebuild the rail system through magnetically levitated trains. Do not let any airline go into bankruptcy. Would we all want airlines as our only mode of transport? No. But can we survive without with them going under? No. We build the dams we have to build. We build the water systems. We have to rebuild three-quarters of the school. The National Education Association says that three-quarters of the school, our physical school plant and equipment, is either defective or overcrowded. That tells you what we have to do there. Rebuild our hospital system, which are being shut down every week through the genocidal HMOs. This type of project will start to generate credit at 1% to 2%. It will then have two effects. The jobs will be created in those industries, but they will be created by these industries also saying, we need cement if we're going to build a dam. We need a generator set. We need machine tools. That means those factories which have been shut down will start producing cement, generators, and machine tools. Those workers will come to work. So you get work in public service and you get work in private industry. As you do this through a multiplier effect, you will start to regenerate the entire physical economy, but not just regenerate. As LaRouche says, we're going to introduce revolutionary technologies like magnetic levitation, like a Moon-Mars mission, which will produce science and bring our economy in a supercharged way beyond where we were even 10 years ago. That credit system of the Super TVA with that infrastructure will start to build on top of what has been collapsed, a new economy, and put back to existence what existed before. And that, the chance of that, I think it's excellent. I think it's excellent based on what we've also seen LaRouche doing in Brazil, Italy, and elsewhere.
Okay, question on this. I think we've convinced some people. We have a question from Lisa, one of our listeners. what do we do about getting out the super TVA? Do we write to our Congress, start demonstrations? As a citizen, what do I need to do to get the word out? Anita, how about taking that up?
Well, Lisa, I think we need to say this is the personal initiative of Lyndon LaRouche. He is the man who had put forward this concept, and we need to have his leadership. We need support for his presidential campaign. We need to educate people around our ideas, and we need to get LaRouche or his representatives invited to speak in every place where the effects of this systemic financial collapse are being felt. And to get the kind of support for him in the United States that Richard referenced is increasingly forthcoming from the rest of the world. So I think it's important to associate the super TVA with LaRouche, with the fact that he is a Democratic presidential candidate. Listeners may be aware that Lyndon LaRouche has emphasized very much recently that the presidency, the institution of the presidency, is the lever through which things move in the United States and in other governments as well. And that's why he always runs for president, and that's why he always deals with executives. And we found yesterday at the Council for State Governments, we were trying to give some people heart who were a little pessimistic about convincing George Bush to go with the super TVA. We reminded them that the Iraq war has been jammed up, not because George Bush did it, but because people around the presidency did it, and that the presidency includes people who are in government, out of government, advisors, and all sorts of people who can affect decisions. So that we need to move through LaRouche's presidential campaign around his personal leadership, and we need to make George Bush be the kind of predecessor for LaRouche presidency that FDR turned Herbert Hoover into.
I'd like to add to that for Lisa and any other listeners that the LaRouche campaign has a number of things in circulation. One, a Thanksgiving message by Mr. LaRouche, which is, I understand the campaign has produced 500,000 copies. I'm going to give out the telephone number for reaching the LaRouche movement. Please call today to get more information. Speak to an organizer. That number, while we're off the air, is 1-888-347-3258. And LaRouche campaign has a specific emergency intervention pamphlet, LaRouche's November program to rebuild the economy, which is a digest of the super TVA actions that need to be taken, and also an earlier bulletin, LaRouche campaigns worldwide for a new Bretton Woods. Now, there's a lot of charlatans and non-solutions floating out there. Some of them have good intentions, like the machinists might have, in their fight for survival as a union. Others might be outright insane, like Phil Graham, or a mixture of both. We have a question, Richard. I think this one is from you. This is from Jean-Philippe Lebleu, organizer in Canada, who sent this email on the fallacy behind Keynes's economic approach. As an organizer in Canada, I had to deal with some wannabe economists who are linking John Maynard Keynes with government intervention. If you could tell me what exactly is the fallacy behind Keynes's economic approach, I would appreciate it.
Well, maybe we should follow that up off the air, but I'll just give you in 1 minute. The first thing you say is he's all wrong. But the key thing is this. He if you ever read his General Theory of Employment, which he wrote in 35, which is very hard to read. Most Keynesians don't read it, so you have to, take a few shots or something and then keep your eyes open with toothpicks. But his whole thing is it's based on, he says in that work and elsewhere, he would base his whole philosophy on Malthus, who was a radical population genocidalist, and on Bernard Mandeville, which most people don't know about. Keynes did. Said he based a lot of his, quote, effective demand on Bernard Mandeville, whose idea is the forerunner of Adam Smith. Now, just to address, there's much more that can be said about Keynes. He was a marvelous liar on a large scale, and had nothing to do with the New Deal, even though people try and foist him onto Franklin Roosevelt, who personally did not like Keynes. And Keynes didn't like Franklin Roosevelt. He, in Keynes' own faggoty way, he said, "Oh, I looked at Roosevelt's hands, and they were so stubby. They were not fluid," which is Keynes. But the thing about Keynes, I think you have to know, is that after the war, in reaction to the people like the von Hayeks and the Milton Friedmans, Keynes was saying, "We use the government." He does not know how to properly use it, but people who correctly knew that you needed to use the government said, "Oh, we must gravitate towards Keynes. Certainly, if our alternative is running into the hands of Milton Friedman, we'll choose Keynes." But the solution is neither Keynes nor Milton Friedman. It's the American intellectual tradition, which traces from Hamilton, from which we got our first national bank, and our greatest president, Lincoln, and the tradition of Roosevelt, in which you use the government, but you use it for productive purposes, a conception that Keynes really did not have, for rebuilding the economy and increasing the cognitive ability of the citizen so that mentally you produce a more powerful person who both can do more work but can create new ideas. That is completely outside Keynes's domain. So we can take the rest of it up off the air, but that's a snapshot.
I'd like to go back to Bob Baker in the conference call and just keep firing those questions, Bob.
Okay, we got a lot more questions. A gentleman from California asked, what is the impact of the trade balance on the budget?
Just this. The trade balance doesn't have a direct effect, but while we're going to run a $400 to $500 billion U.S. the budget deficit, not to be outdone, we will also probably have a $400 billion plus trade balance. And that just means that we're living off the rest of the world, we're looting the rest of the world, taking their goods, which you buy at Walmart, which unfortunately people have to do because they do it because their standard of living could not supply buying some goods like shirts at anything more than $5. But to get them at $5, you have to pay a kid in Bangladesh to work 50 hours a week at 13 cents an hour, which is a hideous way of doing it. And our our trade deficit basically says that America can no longer produce its own existence on its own ability. And we're using goods from the rest of the world to supplement that. Now, if the dollar crashes, and the dollar probably will fall by 40 to 50%, then the whole financial system comes down, and our ability to import $400 billion more in physical goods than we export comes down. And the last point I just want to say is, look, we have J.P. Morgan, Chase, second biggest bank in America, over $700 billion in assets, $25 trillion in derivatives, and it is being supported right now by the Federal Reserve. It's being held up by the Federal Reserve on a light support system. On November 19th, Alan Greenspan addressed to the Council of Foreign Relations in a speech saying, look, we know that there may be significant problems of this credit and other types of derivatives. His solution was Weimar Germany. He says the government will bail out any bank having derivatives problems. But when these derivatives go, and they will go, this brings down the financial system and implodes it. At that point, we have no financial system. And that's where, again, the other part of LaRouche's program, it's a physical part, but there's a financial reorganization that must take place, comes into being.
Thank you, Richard. Bob, do you have another question?
Yes, I actually have two that are similar. Conrado wants to know, how many airlines are still in business? And related to that is... a question, is the value of the airlines more or less than the bailout?
Anita, why don't you?
Well, as to how many airlines are still in business, I haven't checked in the last 5 minutes. So I'm not sure my number would be right. But we have usually what's considered 8 major airlines. There are many small airlines which call themselves regional carriers that are affiliated with some of the major carriers. And of these smaller airlines, or of these major airlines, one already has filed bankruptcy, US Air, which is the 7th largest. One of the very revealing remarks that the chairman of Continental, Gordon Bethune, said repeatedly, publicly, to the press about United was, "We are very happy they did not get a bailout because for us it was a question of survival." Mm. If they had survived, we would not have, or someone else would not have. One of the Chicago University business school economics professors when he first heard the news about the turndown of United for the loan guarantee said, aha, American Airlines has succeeded in defeating United. So, you know, there is an accelerated war of all against all going on among the airlines. And, you know, this is simply the last very ugly phase of what began with deregulation in 1978. The carriers have been fighting with each other over the most profitable routes. Every time one carrier proposes an alliance with another, with a foreign airline or code sharing so that you can fly U.S. Air, but you can also use your frequent flyer miles on some other airline or something like that, there is complaining to the Justice Department. There are antitrust actions. There's every conceivable block because it's all turned into a predator operation. I think the value of the airlines is greater than their worth in bankruptcy, by far. The Alabama retirement system is buying up 37% of U.S. Air for $240 million. And, you know, that is, I think, what used to be something like the ticket price of maybe one new jet. But what's going on now is that the whole airline industry is being sold for pennies on the dollar. 10% of the U.S. airline capacity is parked in deserts in the Southwest, in New Mexico, in California. Some of these planes brand new. United, as of a year ago, had already cut back 25% of its flights. It had a plan about to take effect to cut six more. Under bankruptcy, it will certainly cut at least 12%. So here's an airline that has already shrunk by one-third. And the chairman is talking about greatly accelerated shrinkage. So, you know, when you consider the trained pilots, when you consider the fact that, you know, many of the pilots who were trained are people who were trained in military situations, all of this training and equipment is really irreplaceable in a certain sense. So I think that this is really a kind of bargain basement sale.
Stay tuned for our future shows. I want to tell you next week's EIR has an incredible article on the dirty money behind Ariel Sharon's terrorist networks in Israel. Get in touch with your LaRouche Movement office or visit our website for a copy of this. Thanks for joining us. This is Michelle Steinberg with The LaRouche Show. Come back again.